kind of a different title, but we've been out of the book of Revelation for a while, going back until the end of November. And the reason for that was because in preparation for Christmas and doing the Advent messages around the expectation of Christ coming and our own anticipation or expectation of Him coming again. And so we always take that break. And so to come back into a chapter towards the middle end of Revelation, for us to come back into here, it's just kind of like, you know, we haven't thought about this since early November. And so I'm going to read the verses, but we're going to look specifically because the issue, the tribulation question, you know, the tribulation is going to come, and we've been reading about the tribulation, but the question is, where do we fit in all of this? And I really think that it does make a difference. I think it makes a difference in how we live. I think it makes a difference in what we do. And we'll try to hopefully clarify that and illustrate that and see its importance in our life. And so in Revelation chapter 14, verses 14 to 16. And I looked, and I saw a white cloud. And upon the cloud was one sitting like the Son of Man, having upon his head a golden crown, and in his right hand a sharp sickle. And another angel went out of the temple, crying out with a great voice to the one that sat upon the cloud, "Send forth your sickle and harvest, because the hour of the harvest has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe." And the one who sat upon the cloud sent forth his sickle into the earth, and the earth was harvested. Now, it's a very short passage, isn't it? Easy for us to remember because there's not a whole lot involved. There are two involved in this whole thing. There's one angel who is the fifth in a series, or the fourth in a series that began in chapter 14. And so we find this fourth angel, and we find one that's sitting on a cloud rider. Well, in the Old Testament, God is described as he who rides upon the cloud, but Baal was also described as the one that rides upon the storm. And so in the Old Testament, one of the pictures of God is that when God comes, he comes with all the elements of the world, of nature. He comes with all of these elements, and he's in control of the elements. He's in charge of them. God's in charge of the storm. He's in charge of everything. And that he comes with all of nature and he rides upon nature as he does whatever it is that he is coming to do, whether it's to deliver his people or to bring judgment upon his people. God comes and God works. And that's the picture that it gives. But here we find there's one sitting upon the cloud and he's described like a man. He's pictured like a man. And we think back to the ascension of Christ in Acts chapter 2, or Acts chapter 1. And when Christ ascended into heaven, how did he ascend? What? Clouds. Clouds came, and he rode upon the clouds, and he went into heaven. And the angels that were there with the disciples said to the men, said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand here gazing into the heavens? This Jesus, whom you've seen ascend, he's coming back in the very same way, isn't he?" And so if we're looking for Christ to return, how do we expect him to come? With the clouds. You know, it's always amazing because the cumulus clouds, the ones that stand tall, not these cirrus things that just kind of float through. They're very lovely, but they don't bring a storm, do they? But the ones that build up, the thunderheads that build up, these cumulus nimbus, these big clouds rise up, and you see the sun maybe shining into them or shining through them, and you look up, and that's how we expect Christ to come. This great thunderstorm coming, and Jesus coming with the clouds and returning to the earth. That's the picture, or that's at least the analogy that the Bible gives of us. And so we find this angel, we find this one sitting on the cloud that looks like a man. And as we look at this one, he doesn't describe him other than being a kingly individual. And instead of having a scepter in his hand, he has a sickle, which seems to be an unusual analogy. First of all, the crown. When Christ ascended into heaven, what was his function? What was his purpose? Why did he go to heaven? All right, he died on the cross to do what? Deliver us from our sins. He rose to do what? To give us justification, give us a relationship with God. That's what the last verse of Romans chapter 4 says. that he rose for our justification. So that's what he did. But when he walked for 40 days, as the book of Acts describes, when he walked for 40 days among us, what was the purpose of that? Was that not to confirm and to validate that he was alive from the dead? Because how many of us have seen dead people walking other than on the movies? You know, we don't see dead people walking around, do we? And so it's to give us the assurance that even though he had died, he is alive and he has conquered sin, the grave, and death. All of those things that have power over us, he's overcome all of those, hasn't he? And for 40 days, it's pretty much a confirmation that this one that they saw crucified now is living, and it's beyond doubt. It's beyond any kind of denial. And so the validity of it is pretty well assured with all the witnesses. In fact, when we think about Paul giving us the list of witnesses in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and he goes through all of the occurrences, eyewitnesses, occurrences, and then finally he says, and more than 500 on one occasion. It's kind of hard to deny the testimony, eyewitness testimony of 500 people, isn't it? And so the walking around after the resurrection is to affirm and confirm the resurrection, that he has won. Well, what's the purpose of ascending into heaven? Why not just stay here? Why not hang out with us? Why not let everyone that will ever follow him get a face-to-face meeting with him so he can say, here's what I want you to do with the rest of your life. You know, he can sit and talk to us, and we can hug him, and we can thank him, and we can do all of those things. Why not just hang out here on the earth? And the longevity of his life be over 2,000 years. The longevity of his life would be an affirmation. You know, he is still alive, and it would strengthen our faith, wouldn't it? Why ascend into heaven? Because when he went into heaven, what did he do? He sat down at the right hand of the Father. And what is the seat that he sat on? Is it not a throne? So did he not sit down to reign as king of everything when he sat down? And so when we have his ascension, basically we have his coronation. He is coronated. We inaugurate presidents. They coronate kings. And they come, and when he sits down, he is in session. He is still in session. You know, our Congress sits in session at different times. When they're in session, what do? They make laws, don't they? They sit in committee meetings, they make laws, and then all the things that they do in committee meetings that finally get voted on the House and then in the floor of the Senate, and then it's confirmed by the President, we have to live by, right? And so they work. They do the work of Congress whenever they sit in session. Well, Christ sits in session. He's still sitting, isn't he? He's still sitting when he comes with the clouds of heaven. And so Christ is seated and is in session as king. How do we know he's a king? What's on his head? Who wears a crown? All right, those that wear crowns are those that win beauty pageants. Right? They get a crown. Took him into heaven. And those that are kings. Well, the beauty pageant, that's not so much, is it? That only lasts for one pageant, and then it's over. Or the next year, it's over. But a king, how long does a king or a queen sit? It's a lifetime, isn't it? We think about the Queen of England, and they're always talking about, you know, when her son's going to get a chance, Prince Charles is going to get a chance to sit and take her place. But it doesn't look like she's going anytime soon, does it? She's kind of hanging around for a long time, which for her, that's good. For him, you know, he's kind of cutting into his time. And since guys don't generally hang around as long as women, he's not going to have as long a term as she did, is he? And so he's just kind of waiting around, because as long as she's alive and she wears the crown, she's the queen, right? Well, as long as he is around and he wears the crown, he's the king. So how long is he going to be around? Forever. So how long is he going to be king? Forever. So he sits in session, he is in charge, and all creation and all everything is doing the will of God. Remember, Jesus gave the disciples a sample prayer. And in the sample prayer, he says, pray this: Our Father who art in heaven, may your name be treated like holy. May your will be done on earth. How? As it is in heaven. Now, do you think his will is being done in heaven? You think there's any question? You think there's any rebellion going on in heaven today? No. The rebellion already happened, and anyone that rebelled is cast out, right? They're now demons and devils. But they aren't in heaven any longer, because in heaven, what's being done? His will. How often? All the time. For how long? Forever. Always being done. And so the plea is that His will be done on earth the same way it's done in heaven. And so the only way for it to be done on earth the way it's done in heaven, creation's doing what God wants, isn't it? The natural elements do what God wants, what He's designed them to do, don't they? So the only thing that seems to be in rebellion is whom? People. And so it is for us to submit to treating Him as holy and to do His will while we live upon earth. That's what Jesus asked. But Jesus is in charge. He is king. He sits upon His throne. And His throne, as Daniel chapter 7 says, His throne's not located or isolated to one location. It's not like, as long as we don't go there, we're out of His sight and we're out of His presence. Because, even as Daniel chapter 7 says, His throne is mobile. It moves. Because His throne is wherever He is. And where is He? All the time. Everywhere. So where can we go to be out from underneath the control and out of the presence of God? Or Jesus Christ particularly. Where can we go? Absolutely nowhere. David finally threw it up and he just said, I can't do this anymore. Where can I go? Even while I sleep, I can't get away from You. In bed, I'm with You. And in, when I'm awake, I'm with You. And if I were to go in the depths of the sea like Jonah, I'd still be with You. It doesn't matter where I go, I can't leave Your presence. And even when I was created, when I wasn't even aware of my existence, You were there forming me. So where can we go to get away from God? Nowhere. So where can we go to get away from the reign, the sovereignty, or the kingship of Jesus Christ and His will? Nowhere. And so it's not as though it were isolated and limited to one location. It is wherever He is. But you know, a king generally has some kind of a sign of his dominion. It's called a scepter. You know, it's a symbol of his rule. Why a scepter, I don't know. But that's just the general rule. But who uses a sickle? Who uses a sickle? You remember the USSR, Russia. One of the signs on their flag is what? It's a sickle. Why a sickle? What can you do with a sickle? Now, we don't use sickles anymore much, do we? We have more mechanical means of this, but you use it for harvesting, right? You go out into the field and you take a sickle. You know, I think I still have one. It's a long wooden handle. It's got a little thing here in the middle. It's kind of curved. It's got a big metal blade on it, and you swing it through. You can swing it through grass. You can swing it through hay. You can swing it through wheat, and you cut the stalks off down close to the ground, and it just falls over. And so that's what a sickle does. Well, he's got a sickle and a sharp. Why does the king need a sickle? Remember the kingdom parables of Matthew chapter 13? He talks about the sower, right? In fact, in more than one parable, he talks about the sower. The first one he talks about the guy that goes out and he sows, and some falls by the road, some falls on rocky soil, and some falls on good soil. He talks about the different kinds of sowing, but there's another one. And he says, a man sowed his field in wheat, and while he was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed in tares. And when the wheat and the tares began to grow together, it didn't take long until his servants came and said, you know, we've got a problem here. Didn't you give us good seed? You know, we're looking out here, we got a field that's got wheat and we got a field that's got tares. And they're growing up together. And, you know, if we go out there and stomp all that down and pull them up, we're going to destroy the wheat. So, you know, why didn't you give us better seed? They're blaming the owner of the field because he's the one providing the seed. And he said, no, my enemy has come and done this. He says, just let them grow. Let them grow together. And when it comes time for the harvest, go and gather up the tares first and bind them and then cast them into fire where there will be everlasting fire and weeping and gnashing of teeth, all those real fun things. And then gather in the wheat and bring it into my barn. The sickle. Come out there and it's for cutting wheat. Now, there's much better ways to thrash wheat than with a sickle today, but that's the primitive, and that's what they did, and that's what's available. And it says, using that imagery of the day, you know, not some kind of a combine, but using the sickle, he says, he's got his sickle. So someplace in the reign of Christ, there is a time and a need for a sickle. You remember on more than one occasion, I'll give you two particularly. On one occasion, when he was in John chapter 4, he was sitting at a well and his disciples went into Sychar, this Samaritan village, to look for food. And he sat there and met with a woman that came out to water to gather water in the middle of the day. And after a long conversation with this lady, the disciples are coming back and she's leaving to go back into town. And his disciples said, you know, we got food. And he goes, I'm not hungry. I've already eaten. And they're saying, well, who brought him food? You know, did he get the food from this lady? Where did this food come from? And he says, I have food that you don't know of. It's the food that my Father gives me. My food is to do the will of my Father. And about that time, after the conversation's gone on and they're eating, he looks up and sees the people coming from Sychar, and he says, behold, the fields are white unto harvest. It's time to harvest. These people come out, and in that context of that story, the people from Sychar, after hearing her testimony, came back out, and they listened, and Jesus stayed with them for 2 days, and they say, now no longer do we believe you because of what you, or in him because of what you said, but now we believe because we have heard him ourselves, and they believe that he is the Messiah. And that's the harvest. The harvest of these souls of people who have come to faith in Jesus Christ. On another occasion in Matthew's gospel, Jesus sees the people coming and he tells his disciples, he said, look up, the fields are white unto harvest. Pray that the Lord of the harvest will cast out laborers into the field. And so he uses the harvest analogy Jesus does twice, where he talks about people coming to faith in him. People that are gathering to him and coming to believe upon him as being the harvest, and they're being ripe and being ready. And that's how it's being used here. But in the same context, we will see next week that there is also the other side of it, and that's the tares side of it, that there will be another gathering. But these aren't the wheat. This isn't the sickle for the wheat. This is gathering in grapes. And what do you do? How do you get the juice out of a grape? You ever watch I Love Lucy? Man, I love Lucy. You know, she goes to Paris and, you know, she's there in Italy and she wants to get in there with her dress on, and she got, you know, she's stomping out grapes in one of these big old wine things, and they just keep throwing grapes. And I mean, she gets out and she's got colored legs. Her legs are as purple as the grapes are. How do you get grapes? How do you get the juice out of grapes? You crush them. And so we'll see the other side of it then. But it says that he is bringing about a harvest. Now, you remember in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24, Jesus says, no one knows the hour or the time, not even the angels of heaven or even the Son of Man, but it is left to the Father. No one knows what time that's going to be. Doesn't know when the harvest of the elect, the harvest of God's people, no one knows when that time's going to be. We don't know when it is. Some say, well, it's going to come before the tribulation ever begins. In John chapter 4, when John gets caught up into heaven, he represents the church, and the church is raptured up before the tribulation even begins. After all, Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, God's not appointed us unto wrath, but unto the obtaining of salvation. And certainly the tribulation period's got to be a time of wrath. And therefore, we can't be there because, well, we've not been appointed to that. And so for those reasons, among others, then the church must be up in heaven with John at the time that the tribulation begins. I like that. If we get a boat, we're going to take a boat. I like that. Anyone here like that? Raise your hand if you want pre-tribulation rapture. You like that. All right, come on, hold up your hand. I want to see it. All right. That's probably pretty much most of us, if not all. And we've got some that are holdouts that don't want to hold up their hand yet. But I'd say pretty much for the most of us, if we got to vote, and we don't, that we like that one, don't we? We really kind of like that one. But so far, we've been going through all of these things that started in chapter 6 that began the tribulation. Not the great tribulation, not the worst part of the last 3.5 years. And in chapter 7, if you recall, they were told, the angels, before they poured out the wrath, were told to go and put a mark upon the 144,000 plus a multitude of every kindred, tribe, language, and people. All these people were to be marked as belonging to God and not to be harmed during this time in chapter 7. And now in chapter 14, the harvest is coming, and so in that regard, it seems that this passage has it being when? Mid-tribulation. Somewhere in the middle of this thing, that Jesus on the cloud sends forth the sickle, after he's already marked them off in chapter 7, that he sends forth his sickle, and that they are called up, and they are saved at this, or brought up into heaven at this time, in this harvest of souls, prior to the worst part of the tribulation. They've gone through some, but they won't go through it all. And that somehow or another, he's going to bring them up into heaven at this time. And so we have a mid-tribulation. It seems to give a picture of a mid-tribulation here. How many of you want a mid-tribulation rapture? You don't mind going through some trouble, but you don't want to go through the worst of it. All right, well, wait a second. So far, if we get a vote, if it's a matter of personal preference, most of us don't want to go through any of it. And maybe one hand that said they wouldn't mind going through some trouble, but they don't want to go through all the trouble. But when we get to chapter 19, in chapter 19, after we have the fourfold hallelujahs, then all of a sudden we have the marriage feast of the Lamb, and then we've got Christ coming on a white horse with the clouds and the angels, and it seems that at that point that the tribulation is not going to come, or the rapture is not going to come until the end of the tribulation, when the marriage feast, and they're called and gathered at the marriage feast. And it seems to fit what you find in Matthew chapter 24 when he says, you know, after all of these signs come and after the tribulation begins and when you see the abomination of desolation that causes desolation occur in the temple, then, you know, if you're in the field, don't go back to town. And if you're on the roof, don't go back down. Don't gather your clothes. Just flee. And pray it's not during winter and that you're not pregnant because you don't want it to be during winter. Why? It's pretty nasty outside. In fact, you know, if you get out about 2 o'clock in the morning and we get a good stiff north wind, it's kind of nasty out there even right now, and we don't have the worst of it, do we? You know, I was listening someplace up in Minnesota, hasn't seen above zero the whole month of January yet. Mom and Dad were going to have sub-zero temperatures all day yesterday with wind chill factors down like 19 below. And I'm excited. Praise not during winter. Why? Because we would all freeze to death. Not just feel like we're going to freeze to death, we would freeze to death. And pray you're not pregnant. Why? I mean, is a pregnancy kind of difficult anyway when everything's nice and convenient, when the weather's good? Isn't it still a problem? And so if it's during winter and or you are pregnant, then it's even more greatly difficult. And he says, but the days have been cut short for the sake of the elect. And so there's a good justification to say, well, then it's going to come at the end of the tribulation. But wait a second. It can't be at the first, and it can't be at the middle, and it can't be at the last, and you can't have all three. Now, wait a second. I did a thing. How many of you would like it to be at the end of the Great Tribulation? Like to go through all of that? You know, all the pestilence and all the sickness and all the disasters and everything. How many of you like to go through the whole thing and then be raptured? How many of us really get to vote? None of us. So why did Jesus say no one knows the hour or the time? You see, we don't know. Do we have personal preferences? Sure we do. Sure we do. We all have personal preferences. When I eat my gumbo, I like my potato salad in the gumbo on top, and I like to take and put filet on top of it and then dump my potato salad and then crunch my crackers. But how many of you want to eat your gumbo with the crackers all crunched up in it and filet on it and then have potato salad dumped on top of it? How many of you want to eat your potato salad like, or your gumbo like that? And you see, it's personal preferences. Everybody has a different personal preference, don't we? We all have different personal preferences. But personal preferences aren't getting to choose what's going to happen in the scheme of things. Here's what we know. We know that Jesus Christ is alive and that he rose from the dead. We know he ascended into heaven and he's in control, that he's in charge of all of this. We know that. We know that the Father has a set time when he will tell Jesus Christ it is time to harvest those who know him, and they will be harvested. We know that. So we will ascend into heaven. Every one of us. When will we ascend into heaven? When Jesus comes. When's he come? Well, we've seen it so far that he pictured in all three occasions. We know ultimately he doesn't come until chapter 19, does he? He doesn't come on the horse, and he doesn't come to be present until chapter 19. So we could argue for a post-tribulation rapture, but he's here there now, isn't he? And we could argue for a mid-tribulation rapture. And we also know we're not appointed unto wrath, so we could say, well, pre-tribulation rapture. But we don't know. We don't have a clue. But we do know this. Now, I'm telling you, people get really divided over this issue. I went to a seminary that if you weren't pre-tribulation rapture, you didn't get into the seminary. How did I get in? I said, I don't have a clue. I said, I can defend all three positions. I can give you all the positive arguments and all the negative arguments for all three positions. In fact, I can teach all three positions, but I don't know. And Jesus said, we won't know. But when the angel comes and says it's time, then it will happen. When the angel comes from heaven and says, God says it's time, with a great voice, he tells him, it's time. Send out your sickle. It's time to gather them. It's time. The harvest is ready. Then it will happen. So God's in control. You know what makes me glad about that? What makes me glad about knowing that Jesus Christ is in control? The same reason I'm glad that God's in control of everything else. You know, they make movies about people playing the part of God or wanting to be God. And when people are God, what happens? It's a mess, isn't it? It's all out of whack. I don't want to be in control. I want God to be. Because when he's in control, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are, they always work out. They always come out for the best. His will is always good, perfect, and acceptable, isn't it? It's always the right thing. So I can trust him with my future as well as I can trust him with my present. I can trust him. What should you and I then, what should be the outcome? How then should we live? What should it do for us? When my brother graduated from college, he graduated from a state university that was very large. In fact, the graduation ran 2 days, all day. It started on a Friday morning at about 10 o'clock, and it went until 7 o'clock on Friday evening, and then it began again on Saturday at 10 o'clock, and it went until about 9 o'clock on Saturday evening. It was a long graduation. And so we went up for his graduation, being an S, you know, if you're an A, hey, no problem. You go on Friday morning after the doctoral students in the master's class. Actually, you don't go on Friday morning. You go sometime Friday evening for the A's by the time they do all of the departments and all of that. And so A's begin on Friday night, and then you can kind of figure S's are going to be sometime late on Saturday afternoon, aren't they? And so we go up Saturday morning for my brother's graduation. And, you know, they're just reading off names, and they're marching through like ants across the stage. I don't think anyone was going at the time their name was being read. And my brother and a bunch of his buddies said, you know, there's no reason for us to sit here all day. So they jumped line, and they went across because they don't get their diploma anyway. They get this blank book, and then they mail them the diploma, make sure that they paid all their fees and all, you know, they don't have any outstanding debts to the university. And so they all get in line, and who knows whose names they were reading. But they decided they want to go through early. And so they get in line and they go across and they, you know, get to throw their cap and all of that, turn their tassel, and they have proceeded to go across. And then sometime that evening, his name was read, along with, you know, Zygmunt Zagorski at the end of it. You know, the poor guy that's the last one of all of them. You know, they finally get read. Well, if you know you're going to go early, if you know that you're going to go early, then how do you live? You know, it's, you know, you've got to kind of be ready, don't you? You know that, you know, this evening at 7 o'clock, my name's going to be called. Then what do? You kind of get ready for it, don't you? Like I told the kids a moment ago. You know, if you know that the teacher's there and that she's going to take the paper up, you've got 30 minutes to get it done, are you going to be working on the paper? Yeah, you're going to be working on the paper. But she gives you the paper, she says, I'm going to step out in the hall for just a moment. And I'll be back, and, you know, I'll kind of keep an eye on things, and I'll be back, you know, in just a little bit. But doesn't give you a time frame. You know, and so you kind of work on the paper, and then you look, and someone starts goofing off, and then you kind of look at where you're at in the paper, and you're getting close. You know, you've still got time, and so you start goofing off too, and you kind of forget about the paper, and you start playing, throwing paper wads, and doing all kinds of things kids do. And all of a sudden, the teacher comes in, and she goes, "All right, we're going to collect up the papers. What are you doing?" You know, you go into a cold shock. And so you think, well, you know, the Lord's going to come. You know, I'll know when he's going to come because, you know, tribulation's going to be there. And I think I can pretty well figure it out. You know, we've got tsunamis and we've got earthquakes and we've got fires and we've got, well, you know, I don't know. That's all kinds of the things that it describes that are going to be in the first part anyway, isn't it? You know, some kind of signs in the heaven. Man, we've seen a lot of them in the last 2 decades. Things that have happened. You know, solar eclipse, the lunar eclipse, get to see meteors, get to see an asteroid belt that comes through, all kinds of neat things that have happened in the heavens that haven't happened for millennium. Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. That, I mean, those things. And so, you know, we'll know when it's going to be mid-tribulation because we see all of these things, and we'll know when all of that has happened. And so when it gets a little bit closer, we'll start straightening up and we'll pay more attention to how we're living. You know, if it's at the first, we better act right every day because, you know, it could be tomorrow. I might be driving my car and it'd be gone today. I need to keep everything in count. Mid-tribulation, you know, I think I can read the signs. You know, I'll start getting it in order a little bit later. Post-tribulation, oh, I know when to get it in. You know, when it's all the world's just gone in a handbasket to destruction. I think I'll know when it's going to be. You see, the reality is that each and every one of us, like I told the kids, we are to be awake. The rapture and not knowing is a reminder that we are not to sleep like everybody else sleeps. We're not to get drunk like everybody else gets drunk, but that we're to live soberly. We find each one of the apostles tell us that in some form or fashion. I like what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4, that the time has already passed for our foolishness. It's already enough, it's sufficient. Now it's time for us to be sober, particularly sober for prayer. Sober for prayer, and we are also to be, we are to be about the spiritual gifts that God's given us, and we are to be given to hospitality, entertaining strangers. Because some have even entertained angels unaware in their hospitality to strangers. That there's to be a certain soberness. If we know that Jesus Christ is coming back, and at a time that is ripe, at a time that God says that he will gather us, and when we are gathered, that we will stand before him to give an account, because it's at that point that the judgment seat of Christ will occur, not the great white throne judgment, but the judgment seat of Christ, and we will have to give an accounting, then it seems not knowing should be motivation enough to say, you know, Phil, you need to start checking some of these attitudes. Phil, you need to check your conversation. Phil, you need to check your service. Phil, there's some things in your life you need to start getting under control because one day, the guy that you're going to have to give account for these. You need to put some things into check. You need, like Peter, you need to say, I've had enough time to do this. I need to leave this alone. It's time for me to start doing what God asked me to do. The fact that we don't know ought to be reminder enough. And if we do go through trouble, who here hasn't gone through any trouble? Who here hasn't had some really difficult times? I mean, I think of one of our church members. Her husband passed away in July. She had Ike that occurred in September. She lost a business in Sabine Pass. The other one was greatly damaged and destroyed. She just lost a brand new beach house that her and her husband had built, lost it during Ike, and had major home damage, all within the matter of 3 months. That's horrible. Who hasn't had trouble? And yet, in all the trouble, my trouble seems so small compared to so many others. Of some things that people are going through. So it's not an issue to cry out and say, well, why me, God? If you think your life is in just the toilet, in the pits, go ask Keith to see a couple pictures and see someone else whose life's much worse off than yours. Because I'm telling you, every one of us have reason to give thanks to the Lord and every reason to give God the glory and every reason to serve God now. Because one day we will be called into account. The teacher's going to walk in the room and all the paper's going to be gathered and we won't have a chance to fill in the last blank because it will be over. And we will get what we have, what we deserve. Just like the parable of the man with the talents. And the five, when he was called to accounting, he gave back 10. And the two, when he was called to accounting, gave back 2. And the one who did nothing with the one lost even what he had. Father, as we stand in your holy presence, we know that, God, there's a day that we will see you face to face. We don't know what that day is going to be. We don't know if it's going to be in the morning, if it's going to be in the midday, or it's going to be at night. We don't know when it's going to be, but we know that each and every one of us will stand before you. God, may we live our lives in such a way that, God, we find it comfortable to come into the presence of Jesus Christ with our heads held high, looking at him in awe and amazement because we've loved him, and not in shame and disappointment because though we have known him, we have disregarded every encouragement to live our life with a passion towards him. God, this morning, as we have come to this time, if there are some decisions that need to be made about lifestyle, if there are some decisions that need to be made about faith and following you, if there are some decisions that need to be made about what to do with our lives, God, may we come to a resolution this morning that we settle it today and not wait for another. In Jesus' precious and holy name, amen. Let's stand.